audio for this as of right now. Welcome all to the Q&A for December 2nd, sorry. So as per usual, we will go through the deck, and then anybody who wants to can unmute themselves. I'm going to mute all right now. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. So if you want to
set the recording going?
Yeah, recording is going. And so anybody who has anything to input throughout the meeting, by all means, you can unmute yourself or you could put something into the chat. We'll try and monitor that as we go along. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome, everyone. We've got a few things in the pipe for tonight, so we'll get right to it. And for those of you who joined us late, we just had a little discussion about the smart apps. So if anybody has any useful apps for Android smartphones and tablets, or entertaining apps, or apps that pay you money, apparently, if you tell us what your favorites are, send it to the suggestion box, and we'll, as I mentioned earlier, either create two or three PowerPoint slides, send those along, or if you just send the information, I'll be happy to produce the slides, and then you can just talk to it. And it doesn't have to be Android apps. It could also be a Windows app. We're always interested to find out what kind of programs people find useful. Okay, so I'm actually going to kick it off with a smart app, and I've had this one in the pipe for a little while, but in the current newsletter, the December newsletter, there's a small article on this program. And it's basically how to change the icons on a phone or clearly on an Android tablet. And the reason for this is because I, as you probably know, I'm running a custom ROM on my phone. And I had it updated, excuse me, from Android 8 to Android 9. So I'm now running Pi. And when I did that, I found that all the icons, of course, changed. But I really didn't like this, what I consider to be a very ugly app icon, rather, that they use for the calendar. And I'd quite like to replace it. And I found a nicer, by doing a Google search, I found what I think is a much nicer icon, which Google uses on their Pixel phone, this icon down here. So what I need is an app that will let me switch these icons on my phone. And when, again, by searching, you find there's a bunch of apps that do that. And the one I settled on is called Awesome Icons. And it's written by a couple of Finnish IT guys. It's a free app on the Google Store. And basically, so I installed it. And you also need some icons. So I started off with an icon pack called Glim. And it has lots of icons, and it's actually quite tricky to find the icon you want in some of these icon packs. But eventually I trimmed it down, and when I run the program, I want to modify this app. And Glim has a calendar app. It has this little blue and white thing down here, a rectangular one. So I want to modify the ugly one with this one for now. So when you run the program, you basically get this screen right here, and it shows you you navigate down to the app that you want, and then it shows you the current app, which is Calendar, and then the label, the app that you want to change. So right now it's just showing me the same one because I haven't told it I want to do anything different. The calendar, the label for the app, and some advanced controls. So basically what I need to do is select the image source here, and it gives me a bunch of different options for that. And then I have the option to edit the caption, so I could change that to say something else, but calendar makes perfect sense. And then as you'll see in a minute, we have these controls that we can play with to do various things. All right, so here we are. we've got the old calendar app, and we want to select the source for a new image. So when we do that, we have a number of options. We can choose an icon which is available for the application, and that's very limited. We can go to an icon pack, and I've already got Glim loaded, so I can do that. I can also choose a picture, which is another image, an image file. Or I could use the camera and actually take a picture and use that. Well, right now I've already got this Glim pack loaded, so I'm going to play with that. So I choose the default icon, which Glim has for its calendar. And then now I've still got these controls to worry about, and it's not very specific what these things do. So I start off by just leave the create widget checkbox, just leave that check and see what happens. And I go to the next screen and it says, well, add automatically, which basically adds the icon that we've changed onto the current screen. So I'm working on my second screen here. So when I add the icon, I notice that it's much larger than any of the other icons on my phone. And it's also rectangular, where all the other ones are circular. So that kind of makes it stand out a bit, which I don't particularly like. So if I go back to the main screen there and uncheck the create widget box and try again, I get a different icon. And now it's circular, which is good. It's about the same size, which is also good. But now it has this little shortcut icon added to it, which I don't particularly like. Anyway, I find out that there's actually another way of developing the icon. So if you go to any area of the screen, any blank area of the screen, and just click and hold it, then it pops up this box where you can select widgets. So I choose widgets, and then I scroll down until I find the awesome icon widgets, and I choose this shortcut one by one. And now I get back to this screen. So I tap the thing that I want to launch, and I choose calendar. And now I can choose what I'm going to replace it with. And this time, instead of going to the Glim icon pack, I'm going to choose picture. And I'm going to browse for this pixel icon that I've actually downloaded as a file called calendar.png. So it's just a regular image file. I'm going to replace the ugly icon with the image file that I've downloaded from the web. So I select OK, and bingo, it drops the icon onto the screen. So now all I have to do is on my main screen, on the home page, I drag the original icon away and get rid of it, remove it, and then drag this one into place. And now you can see that right here, I've got my Google Pixel icon as my calendar icon. So it's a really easy way of generating any old icon you want instead of the one that is forced down your throat. So again, the Awesome Icons is the name of the program, and it's available on the Play Store, Google Play Store.
The URL has been pasted into chat for anybody who's looking for it. You can copy it from there.
And it's also in the newsletter, so be my guest. Okay, so moving right along. I think this was a problem by Glenn, I think. No, it wasn't. It was...
I think it was Willem Bill.
Sorry, we just went backwards. The problem was that Bill was booting his computer, and it wasn't connecting to his network attack storage, the NAS box. Sometimes it failed. Sometimes it takes lots of different attempts. Usually it's a problem when Windows first boots. But once it's connected, then it stays okay for the rest of the session. So Chris had some thoughts about how to cure this problem
Yeah, this is a little bit more generic than Bill's problem that he had. It turned out that I thought it was dropping, Windows was dropping the connection when he wasn't using it for a period of time. And so I suggested that he actually do something that will periodically pull that drive and just keep that connection alive. His problem isn't really that, but this will be a generic sort of solution to anybody who has a similar type of problem. So you can do something to force that connection to the drive. So you could go to File Manager and just click on the drive and make it read it. And even if you're not interested in it at that point in time, it'll actually make it come alive. But as I say here, that's so manual. And I really don't like manual things if I can avoid having manual stuff to do. So actually, I'm going to take over now. And rather, the slides here are they'll all be in the PDF that gets posted on our website. But rather than taking you through this, I'll actually throw caution to the wind, and I'm actually going to take you through a live demo. We can always revert to the slides if horrible things happen. So let me just minimize some stuff here. Okay, so another thing that I could do is just come to a command prompt. So if you just do run and type in CMD, you'll get command prompt there. So I've run command prompt, and I could, if I was trying to keep drive Z alive, I could just do dir Z colon and does a directory listing. Well, in order for it to get a directory listing, if the drive has gone to sleep or the connection has been broken, it'll have to reestablish that or wake up the drive in order to do a directory listing. So that's going to make it come alive and be available. Why is that better than, I could come in every half hour and do that. But that, again, is so manual. But the benefit of doing from a command prompt, dir Z colon, is that I can script it. And if I script it, I can also automate it. Okay, so let's look at a script that will actually do this, what I really want it to do. So if I go into File Manager and I come to drive Z, I've got a script here that I wrote called keepalive.cmd. So let's take a look at that one. So we have at echo off. At the start of the line means that the current command will not be echoed to the command prompt when you actually run it. So in this case, I'm turning echo off, and I'm suppressing the actual display of that command echo off. So I just always start all scripts with that. Then I have a label. Anything starting with a colon is a label, which means that I can jump to that point anytime that I want to. Then I come down and I do the dir Z colon backslash. Okay. Now the rest of this on this line here is only here for basically testing purposes, because if I do dir Z colon, I'm not watching it. Do I actually see anything? Do I know that it's actually working? I don't necessarily know that. So what I do is I redirect the output from the dir Z colon to a file that I can then look at. One greater than symbol will actually redirect to that file, but every time it runs, it will overwrite the file. If I do two greater than signs, it'll actually append to the existing file. And so what I'm doing is I'm taking the dir, every time it actually does dir Z colon backslash, it actually redirects that to the output to a file called keepalive.log. And then I do timeout, which is built into Windows 10, Windows since I think Windows 7 at least, timeout was there. So in this case, it's going to time out for 2 seconds. So it's going to just pause. Nothing's going to happen and for another 2 seconds. Now, why only 2 seconds? In the actual live use of this, I probably don't need to do a dir every 2 seconds. Might be only 30 minutes will be enough to keep that drive alive. But for testing purposes, I'm going to put it in 2 seconds so that I can test it and I don't have to wait 30 minutes to see if everything is working properly. After it does that pause for 2 seconds, then it goes go to keep alive. What does that mean? It jumps up to here in the script, which then goes down, does another dir. So this is going to loop in continuously until I stop the script from running or shut down the computer. Okay, so what happens if I actually run this? So if I just double click on this, And you can see that it's actually just waiting 2 seconds, and then it's looping through. And I don't actually see the other commands because I did an echo off. I'll do a control C to just terminate this. And we'll now look at, we have this keepalive.log file. And if I open that, we can see that it's actually done a directory listing. It waited 2 seconds, did another directory listing, and so forth. And it's just continuously doing that. And so the script is working how I want it to work. Okay, I'm going to just delete this. And ding. Okay, so now I can come into Windows and I could just run this. And it will just sit there running as long as my computer is running. But that, again, is so manual. Why don't we actually automate this script so that it just happens whether I think about it or not? So if I come here and run task scheduler, this is the way within Windows that I can actually automate tasks according to my needs. So over here on the right-hand side, I have create task as an option. Brings up a dialog box. I give it a name. So I might call this exclamation mark keep alive. Why do I do exclamation mark? Because the tasks that are in here by default are sorted by name. So that means my tasks will all come at the top because I always name them exclamation mark and then the name of the task. I could actually come in here on the task scheduler library and if I think it worked, I could come to there, I could right-click on it, I could actually create a folder. I could create all my tasks in a particular folder, but I'm just going to go with this. And then always put in a description because you don't want 5 years later you go, oh, what the heck is this task all about? So I'll say keep drive Z alive by polling every 30 minutes or whatever I have. Okay, then I have to look at what do I actually want to have happen. So I come to the Actions tab, and I create a new action. And you have a couple of actions that'll happen, but it's interesting. They're deprecated for sending an email or displaying a message, but it would actually work if you wanted something there. But what I want to do is start a program. In this case, it's a script. And if I browse, I can then go to Drive Z. I can pick up my keepalive.cmd. Click on open. I could add arguments to it if I had to pass a parameter. I don't in this case, so that's fine. Now I want a trigger. When do I want this to actually occur? And so if I create a new trigger, you can do it on a schedule, log on at startup, on idle. There's a whole bunch of different things that you can use as triggers for this particular scheduled event. So I'm going to do it at log on. Now, you could do it at startup, but one of the problems with this particular script, doing it at startup, that's before anybody's logged onto the computer. What if you need to be logging into this particular device as a user, and that drive is not connected until such time as you're logged on? So I'm going to do it at logon, and I could do it for any user that logs onto the computer. There are a bunch of other things here, but I don't particularly have to worry about them at all. And that's all I need to do on here. Click on OK. And then I have my task is there. It's going to run this script, and it's going to do it at logon of any user. Click on OK. My task is created. And I could actually just run this task right now. So I can right-click on it rather than logging off and logging back on to actually trigger it. I can just right-click on it and say run. And sure enough, my script is actually going to run. Now, that's pretty ugly, though, because it comes up with a big black box on my screen. Now, I could just minimize it by clicking on the minimize button over at the top right and leave it running on my taskbar. But there is another way that we can actually get around that. So I'm going to break that script. Now, if we go back in and we modify that script, we go back to the properties of it. Right now, it's running as Karina, which is the name of my computer, C. Taylor, my username. What I can do is I can come in here and change user or group and I can type in system. I want it to run as the operating system, not as a particular user. Click on OK, and now it comes back saying /NT Authority/System, and I click on OK. Now, when I right-click on that and I say run, the task is actually running, and I can prove that. Actually, let me stop the script from running, and all instances. I'm going to come back to File Manager. There's my log file. I'm going to get rid of that. So log file is not there. And to prove that this is actually running properly, I can come in here and say run. I don't see anything on the screen. I don't see any command prompt other than the one that I had before. I could actually even close that one. So I don't see a command prompt running anywhere. Yet, if I go to my file manager, there's keepalive.log. If I look at it and open it, I can see that it's actually being written to. Okay? So that's about it. Let me actually stop that script from running. So I come back into here and I end that script. Now things will be stopped. Now what I would do, now that I've tested it, I could actually come in. Let me do it through File Manager. And if I go to here and edit this, I could then come in and I could remove this if I wanted because I know it's working properly. So it's just doing the DIR. I don't need to see the output from it. And I could change the timeout to maybe 300 or something like that, which would give it 5 minutes. So every 5 minutes it would run, or whatever timeout in seconds that I actually want. From then on, my computer will actually, every time that anybody logs on the computer, the script will run in the background, just periodically doing that DIR to the drive that I want to be ensure is kept alive and should do the trick for it. Any questions on that?
Now, one comment. Micheline says it's a great topic for a possible newsletter article, Chris.
I've done some other ones similar to that as newsletter articles, and it is in the or will be in the deck for tonight's presentation, so it will be available through there. But I have had a couple of articles in the past on scripting. This was just another example of a scripting option that happened to come up. Any other questions, comments? Okay, Alan, I think you can take over control again and lead us through the rest of the deck.
Okay, so you should be seeing the next question.
Yep.
Which is, I forget who this was now. Somebody looking for a free alternative to Microsoft Office. It has to be able to open and save Office files. PDF would be nice, but not necessary. So this is a question for everybody. Any opinions on LibreOffice, OpenOffice, FreeOffice, or anything else? But whatever you suggest, it has to be compatible with both Windows 8.1 and Windows 10. So why are you thinking about that?
Just to give credit where credit is due, it was Natalie that asked this question.
Natalie, yes. My apologies, Natalie. I've forgotten who it was. So while everybody's thinking about your favorite Office product, let me tell you about mine. I've used LibreOffice for quite a few years. I was using OpenOffice, and then they forked it to LibreOffice. Now, the nice thing about LibreOffice is it can read and write Office files, and it can also save them as PDF. It's pretty compatible, but it's not 100%, as you'll see in a few minutes. But the good news is it's completely free. So my suggestion would be give this one a try, and if it works, fine. If it doesn't, then throw it away and find something else. As I mentioned, LibreOffice is a fork from OpenOffice. When OpenOffice was taken over by Oracle Corporation, there was a lot of dissension in the developer ranks, and most of the developers went over to this new product called LibreOffice. And subsequently, OpenOffice moved from Oracle, and now it's an Apache product. So it's called Apache OpenOffice. And the reason you can fork it, of course, is because it's open source. So people take the source code, modify it, and then release it under the GPL. If you're not familiar with LibreOffice, then it has a number of different modules. It has Writer, which is equivalent to Microsoft Word. It has Calc, which is essentially the same as Excel. It has Impress, which is a PowerPoint clone. And it also has Base, which is a database manager, which is very much like Access. And the thing to note here is that normally when you buy the Office suite, Base is not with the base Office suite. You have to buy it separately or buy an upgrade to get the database manager. With LibreOffice, it comes with it. Now, I only use the first three modules, so I'm not going to talk about Base, but just to point out that it is available in the package. The good news is it's pretty compatible. So here I'm showing you side by side, opening exactly the same doc file, or docx file actually, in Microsoft Word on the left and in LibreOffice Writer on the right. And this is a simple text file. It has an underline character after the abstract. But basically it's pure text and it's reproduced essentially one to one. And I also open one of Lawrence's public address notices. And previously, LibreOffice has had a real problem with this formatting. It's quite complex, and LibreOffice made a mess of it. However, you can see now that in Word and in Word on the left and LibreOffice on the right, it's essentially reproduced it perfectly. So the new version of LibreOffice has much better fidelity than older versions of LibreOffice. So Writer seems to work pretty well. In the past, I've had problems with spreadsheets, and this is a spreadsheet, an accounting, it's actually the club's accounts. A summary of the club's accounts in LibreOffice. And if I open the same, this time it's an ODS file, an open document spreadsheet. If I open the same file in Microsoft Excel, you can see that I pretty well get the same results. If you look at the bottom line down here, it's showing that the balance is correct and we're $180.83. To the good in terms of income over expenses. And in Excel, the balance is correct, $180.83, correct. And clearly, we've got a whole bunch of formulae in here, calculating sums and differences. And then this one is clearly matching a bottom line number here to a bottom line number up here and deciding whether it's the same or not. So there's some logical type expressions in there, and the highlighting is all reproduced properly and so forth. And one of the problems I had earlier when I tried to do this a few years ago, I wrote a newsletter article and I opened up an ODS file in Excel and I got the same result. But then when I changed one of the numbers, the total didn't change. And what Excel had done was it opened the open document file, but it didn't copy over the formulae. It only copied the values. Well, having a spreadsheet with just values and no formulae is pretty useless. But nowadays, again, if I change the number, if I put a pseudo $99 in here, and now the balance is incorrect by $279, and I change the same number in Excel, it's incorrect and it's $279. So Excel is now again mirroring the performance of the LibreOffice Calc. The other problem with LibreOffice is that it doesn't support Visual Basic for Applications, VBA, which is the Microsoft Excel macro programming language. Now here I've got a file which is an Excel file. And I've clearly got a bunch of macros because I've got some control buttons here. And then I've got the results of what's going on. And what I want you to look at here is I'm going to take, this is a, EDR. It's an event data recorder. So it's measuring crash pulses. So I've got a real live vehicle here, and I want to compare it to this test with the Cavalier and this second test with the Cavalier. And if I click down here on view the chart, then it pulls up the chart, and I can see that the red line is my 48 kilometers per hour frontal barrier test. The green line is a 40 kilometers per hour offset deformable barrier, which is much softer. So we get a high spike here in the acceleration profile, a much lower and longer pulse. And then the black line is the actual vehicle, which had a event data recorder on board. And we can see that the real crash is a bit more like the offset deformable test rather than the rigid barrier. Anyway, that's so basically I've got a macro here, which when I click on this thing, it pulls up the chart. Now, normally, if I did that in Calc, I wouldn't expect that. So here's my Excel file being opened in Calc. I click on the view chart, and bingo, I get the same chart popping up. So that macro is actually working, which amazed me. However, supposing that I decide, well, I want to change the 48 kilometers per hour test data. So this is now Excel. So if I click on this button here, it pops me up a table of different tests. And I decide, well, I'd like to see how this vehicle looks against a 48-click test with a Trailblazer, a big utility vehicle. So let's select this chart. And now it says, okay, now your 48 kilometer is selected. You've selected the Chevy Trailblazer. And I'd get a different chart. All right, so now I'm opening it in Calc. So here's my select the different test. It pops up the same chart of different chart crash tests. So I choose the Trailblazer, and I go down here, and I select the 48 kilometer per hour test, and oops, I get a basic runtime error. So now the macro, the underlying macro, you can see it's popped up LibreOffice Basic here. The macro code is being displayed, and there's the problem. And basically, it's trying to format my selection confirmation in green, and it's choking on this line for superscript equals false. And that's because Calc is using LibreOffice Basic and Excel is using Visual Basic for applications, and they're not 100% compatible. So that's an issue if you do macro programming and you want to use Calc rather than Excel. And that's one of the reasons I have to use Excel, because my buddy insists that I program everything in Microsoft Excel. Now, the third program that we use is PowerPoint and Impress. So here's tonight's PowerPoint deck being opened in Microsoft PowerPoint. And here's one of the final slides where it says, send your questions to suggestion box and don't forget. And the little man here with the red arrow. And that's PowerPoint. Right. So if I do the same thing in Impress, I get the little man. I've got the yellow sticky. I've got the same text. I've got the blue text here. It's basically a one-to-one perfect reproduction. However, supposing I look at a file that I used a couple of weeks ago, and we're talking about files and folders, and I had this slide which was talking about the pictures library, which Windows uses, and pointing out that pictures is really a link to this actual real folder name. And then I've got this clip out box here, which is talking about links. So that's in PowerPoint. Now, if I use the same slide in LibreOffice Impress, I got the title and the text and the image are good, but my pullout box is using the wrong font. It's garbling the text, it's moving the box over the end of the actual slide. So again, here's an incompatibility between Impress and PowerPoint. So they're pretty good, but they're not 100%. So now you've all been thinking about what I've been saying, and you've been thinking, well, my office suite is much better than that, right? So now you can tell me, or you can tell Natalie, which free office suite you would suggest, and maybe you'd like to mention why.
We have one comment in the chat from Stuart that there's no direct Android version, so this will be for your phone, of LibreOffice, but there is an Android office, OpenOffice, that handles it quite well. So I don't think I would want to do an awful lot of work in on a phone, but it looks like that's an option that is available if you do want to be able to do things on your Android phone.
By the same token, it could be a big tablet, and you could also use a Bluetooth keyboard and share it, you know, screencast it. And
yep.
So yeah, you can use your phone as a computer. So does anybody have any other suggestions for free office suites?
While we're waiting for the comments to flood in, I will mention that you can get the Microsoft Office apps on Android for free. So that is an option as well for Android users.
Well, we can come back to this topic later if anybody has any bright ideas or if you want to send us some suggestions later on.
Yeah.
So moving along, I've been getting a whole bunch of email messages from people telling me that my payment has been accepted. Your payment was successfully received. All documentation are attached to this message. And they're attaching it as a .xls file. Why do I have the feeling that that's a scam and this has probably got malicious intent built into it? And the question is, can you be attacked just by the process of opening email to read the text, even though you don't click on any links or open any file attached to the message? And this came from Glenn, who has just had a Bell payment declined. But when he looked at the email, clearly it wasn't coming from Bell. So he's saying sometimes you can get tricked by opening something that looked really authentic, but it's actually spam. And is there a browser or an email setting that will prevent this kind of attack? And Chris has some thoughts on this, I know.
Yeah, sometimes in the past, there was the ability for a lot of email clients to actually run what is normally termed to be active content in an email. So it would normally be something like JavaScript or something like that, that when you open it, the email client would interpret that JavaScript and try to do whatever the script said to do, which could be bad things. So at least in theory, it's possible for bad things to happen simply by opening the email without doing anything else active in the email itself. But that pretty much has gone away. Email programs now, they shut off all of that means of exploiting computers. That was probably over 10 years ago I saw that most of those got undone. And so as a general rule, it's only when you do something with the content of that. So if you have a link, certainly if you click on a link, you could be taken to a website that is maybe trying to compromise your computer. It may or may not be successful depending on whether you have vulnerability on your computer that hasn't been patched yet or whatever. Or if you have an attachment that you double click on to open that attachment, if it is actually programming code in there, it could execute. So, and Alan's example of an XLS file, that's not necessarily safe either because an XLS file can include things like Visual Basic for applications embedded in it that could try to do something. Now, email clients or Excel and all of the Office programs, they are designed to not allow code to run by default. You usually have to jump through a few hoops to allow for any code to run. But as well, it could be a brand new vulnerability that has been found in whatever program is opening up the particular file, including things like, you know, if it's a PDF file, it could be a security vulnerability in Adobe Reader that will get triggered just by opening that. So certainly clicking any links or anything like that or opening file attachments once you look at the email could be dangerous things to do. The reason why I sort of couch all of these things in a little bit by default as a general rule in the past and things like that is that when it comes to security on a computer, there is no such thing as 100% security. There's going to be always somebody who's going to come along tomorrow, next week, next year, who's going to come up with a new exploit for which you are not aware or the software on your computer is not aware, and it could compromise your computer. There's an old saying I heard or read, the only true secure computer is encased in concrete and dropped in the middle of the ocean, and even then I'm not 100% sure. And that's actually not a bad way of thinking about security on a computer. Don't think of things as being 100% secure. Okay, B just wrote, is there a way to find out what the email address is without opening the email equivalent to rolling over the sender? Without opening it, not likely, but some programs might allow you to hover over it just in the list of emails. You might be able to get the properties of the header, which could display the email, full email address, but typically you would have to open it. But as I say, as a general rule, I don't worry about opening an email. I do worry about clicking links or opening attachments, but just looking at the email itself, which will allow you to either hover over the email address or right-click on it and copy the email address to the clipboard or something like that, that's all safe to do.
I think I saw Lawrence waving his hand.
I do want to add something to what Chris had said. To the properties, or sorry, to B's question about whether you can find out whether a spoofed email is in fact real or not, I know in Outlook, I suspect in other email programs, but Outlook is my poison of choice, whether I want to or not. And you can go into the file properties and scroll through the text that is provided as part of the email that shows the routing information as to where the email came from, and if you have a spam filter, if it's going through a spam filter based service, the details on that. If you scroll through it, you will eventually come to seeing where the original address, email address is. But to Chris's point, you know, there are things that you probably shouldn't touch, and if you're not sure, i.e. you think it's from a friend that you trust, and you're saying, well, I've always gotten good stuff from this individual, or I've never gotten bad stuff from this individual, but again, you're still not sure, just use your wise trust actions and call a friend, or put it out to the computer club, as you've done, and get advice. I mean, Chris, Alan, and I, amongst others, if you give us enough detail, we can pretty much give you a heads up of whether we think it's good or not. I know sometimes I have to take a deep dive on some of the emails that we get, and there turns out there's been a couple of times where an email's come in that, boy, it looks bad. It looks suspicious. It looks like I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and it was legit. So.
Yeah, anyway. And then along with that point, too, realize that, as a general rule, email addresses are not authenticated. There are some
Right.
Possible means of authentication, but they're not perfect and they're not 100% widespread, so nobody really can count on them. So I could easily send you an email that says it's from god@heaven.net, and without delving into things a little bit deeper, it'd be very hard for you to tell that it wasn't God speaking from on high to you in an email. Lawrence mentioned about looking at the headers, and certainly, you know, going into the headers, it can be a little bit of a deep dive and a little bit of trying to scratch your head and interpret things. Yeah. But I have done things like going through spam. There's a spam testing site that you can take all of the headers from a message and paste it in there, and it'll tell you if it comes from a, you know, it's gone through a server of a known spammer. I might use something like that if I was to get, you know, an email from, say, Linda, who's on Simpatico. And so if that email happened to travel through Lima, Peru, it probably didn't actually come from Linda. You know, there's no reason why my email would get routed, her email to me would get routed through Lima, Peru. You know, so there are some things you can do. Some of them can take you a little while to actually do the sleuthing. But it is possible. But Lawrence's point is really, really good. If you're at all suspicious, pick up the phone and call the person or email them separately. Don't reply to that email. You know, email them separately or send them a message. Say, did you really send me this email? You know, and wait for that reply before actually doing anything with that email.
If you do a reply like that, Chris, and it's a spammer at the end, he'll say, sure, I sent you the email.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
One other point, the example given, and I've been read another article in the last 2 days. Long story short, the baddies have figured out that Excel version 4 macros are the baddies' gifts from heaven or from the devil, whichever way you want to look at it. And they have been, for the past several months, and I can vouch for the number of spam email that they're getting. The funniest is the one that comes in saying, hey, this is my resume. Please open it. And it's an Excel file. Really? And a resume is an Excel file? No, I don't think so, for multiple reasons. Either way, this is the baddies' favorite trick right now. And they are supposedly expanding on it, using stuff like, there's programming techniques that are beyond my level of understanding, but even stuff like putting in macros into the sheet and using the oldest trick in the book and putting all the fonts in white so that it doesn't appear when you look at the sheet that it's embedded in. So anyways, the Excel files are, everybody's receiving them.
I wonder how efficient that is, though, Lawrence, because I thought the newer versions of Excel turn macro programming off by default. Not a macro programmer.
And thank you for that, Alan. So the other side of this is that in the majority of cases, if you try to open up an Excel or a Word, but Excel is the big favorite right now, or PowerPoint, you will get my office, the newer offices, that will say, hey, this is running a macro. And sometimes they will come up with two additional warnings to not open this. Now, the baddies, they will coach their language to say, you must open this. You have to open this. Your life is depending on you opening this. Any little trick that they can do to lure you in and try to bypass common sense warning messages. And gosh darn it all, I've seen it happen. And then I say to the people afterwards, why? And they'll give a variety of excuses. Either way, when you see a warning, even if you think it's from someone you know and trust, stop what you're doing. I'm afraid my dad loves sharing jokes with his colleagues and that, and I'm afraid one of those is going to bite us in the butt. So for the same reason. But anyways, I digress. Excel files are the baddie's best trick right now, and they are pushing it out in waves.
Well, apparently there's another baddie's trick out there, and Chris is going to talk about it.
Yeah, I came across this today. It was interesting. Sophos in their blog, they put out this article today. How safe is your digital doorbell? And you think a digital doorbell, you know, how bad can that be? All it does is ring a bell, you know. But they have this article, and I put it the link there, and I will post it into the chat as well. If I can just do that right now. I've got the both of them, I believe. There and whoops. All right. I'll post in the other one. So I don't know. I don't have that. Oh, there it is. Okay. So I'll post that. Okay, so the two links are posted in there. So Sophos had a comment, a lot can go wrong with your internet-enabled doorbells. They also had a statement, reduce if these are compromised, it can reduce both your physical and your online security at the same time. They referenced an article from Which, we've talked about them before. They're out of the UK, and they're sort of like Consumer Reports type magazine or online service, and they actually tested 11 doorbells, including things like I guess these are epitomized by the Ring doorbell that is available on the market. These are not cheap. I mean, they go for, you know, some of them about $120 up to several hundred dollars. They tested 11 doorbells. All 11 had what they deemed to be high-risk security issues on them. One of them was they found that it was actually uploading the local Wi-Fi password from the device to the vendor server in China, unencrypted. The figure they need your Wi-Fi password for, God only knows. Another one they found was that a device could be forced into setup mode from outside your house. So anybody out on the street could actually force it into a mode that they could then take control of that particular device. Not only because it is on your Wi-Fi network, once they're on your Wi-Fi network, typically they have an awful lot more capabilities to access other devices within your house. Your smartphones, your tablets, your other computers, and so forth could be compromised by virtue of the fact that they're compromising a device that's on the private side of the network. So interesting articles. I just threw in the URLs to them. If you're thinking about things like smart devices, which we were talking about these just a couple of weeks ago, you might want to think twice about smart devices that you attach to your network.
Okay, so moving along, we have a question which is actually posted on the members only forum. There's about five parts to it, if you've seen it there. But basically, it's all about messenger.com. This is from Micheline. Do text messages that you send go to a phone or to a Facebook account? Can I select which device or account is going to be used? And how do I check if a message has been received? So does anybody out there, I don't use messenger.com, I know very little about it. So if anybody uses it and can provide any insight into that, unmute your microphone and let us know. I just looked at this very quickly on the web and I noticed down here, it says, Messenger powers conversations within Facebook, Instagram, Portal, and Oculus. So to me, that says it's linked into all kinds of social media platforms, but it's not an SMS text message device.
That's my understanding as well. Messenger is its own animal that it wants to be similar to what the Apple what's Apple's texting called?
FaceTime is that video one.
Yeah, FaceTime's the video one. I forget what the Apple one is. Anyways, Messenger, to answer these questions, you can use Messenger you just access your Facebook account on your PC on a browser, and therefore you can use Messenger on your browser using your Facebook.com account to log in. You can have Messenger as an app on your mobile device. Can you select which device account is to be used? I'm not sure I understand that particular question. And how do I check if a message has been received on your mobile device? I know on mine, you have a notification like a typical text message, and it will beep at you, and actually it has a little circle thing that will stay on your screen until you drag it down and out of the way to let you know that you got a message waiting for you.
And I guess what Michelin is really looking for is an app, a desktop app, a PC app, I guess, that will let her send an SMS text
right
to a phone.
Yeah.
And Stuart's suggesting, I think, use Telegram because that's supposed to be secure. So I think Telegram is a Windows app, is it not?
It is available on Windows.
So that could be used for sending text messages to phones?
I don't have any real familiarity with it, so I can't really speak to it. Perhaps, Stuart, if you're using Telegram.
Hello?
Yep.
I just installed it a couple of days ago to try out because for the benefit of my wife and the in-laws, who all text each other like crazy all the time and are always complaining about messages not going through and whatnot. Anyway, Telegram is supposed to be a very secure multi-platform messaging app, really popular with activists all around the world, people in Hong Kong that are trying to overthrow the government, yada, yada, yada. I really can't speak to how well it works because I've only tested it with one message to the computer sitting beside me, and that worked. But it's supposed to be quite good. That's all I can say.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Welcome.
So did anybody have any further thoughts about free office programs or anything else?
Oh, Bob Harris posted, I have a Wyze camera watching my front door, plus a few inside our house. Wyze has limits, but they cost only $40 each. Free cloud storage for 14 days, all videos sent to my cell phone. Let's hope it's not also sent to China. That's actually, you know, the Sophos article. They talked about, you know, what can you do about this? And, you know, their long and short of it is that there's not an awful lot the average consumer can do to make sure that any devices that you buy and attach to your network are actually secure. You know, there might be some red flags, like, you know, a default password that you can't change or something like that. But even if everything looks good, you know, I don't have any capabilities to actually validate whether things are working properly. For me to try to figure out, is my doorbell sending my Wi-Fi password unencrypted to a server in China? You know, I don't really have means to do the tracking on that. I could set it up, I suppose, but it'd be very laborious and fraught with all kinds of difficulties. So it's really, really difficult to say whether you're putting your network at risk by using these particular devices.
I want to know how I ring Bob's Wyze camera doorbell.
Yeah, that's right.
But would that apply to Google Home and things like that? Or why is it not restricted to doorbells, I'm assuming, but
no.
Wouldn't it apply to...
Yeah, it would, but why I would be a little bit less worried about Google Home or Amazon, any of those devices, is they are used and abused by millions of people, and there are a lot of people that are looking at those and trying to find out, are there vulnerabilities that they can make a name for by exposing vulnerabilities? So really big name stuff I'm less worried about than the knockoffs that are the no names that you buy from, and you don't know where they're coming from, and you don't know the reputation of it. One of the ones that they came out in those articles, they found two different brand names, and they looked somewhat similar, and turned out they had exactly the same vulnerabilities. So somebody was doing a knockoff of somebody else's product, and they were duplicating the vulnerabilities in addition to the capabilities of the device. So long and short, yeah, Amazon Echo, I'm not particularly worried about. Google Home, I'm not particularly worried about. I will keep an eye on things so that if I see something in the press that says, oh, a vulnerability has been found, and here's how you can fix it, then I'll fix it. But, I mean, if I want any home automation at all, that's my route, is I tend to stick with the best names just because they're going to be looked at more with more scrutiny.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. A while back, I bought a pack of smart plugs and a pack of smart light bulbs at Costco. And the package said they were compatible with Amazon Echo and Google Home. Now, the reality is you have to put in their app into your smartphone to link their products with Amazon Echo or Google Home there and everything. So that in itself creates a huge vulnerability because you're only depending on whatever security Amazon or Google has, but you're depending on this company's app to also have some sort of security.
Well, the flip side to that, though, Bob, is that once it's done the connection through to the Echo or the Google Home, you can actually delete the manufacturer's app off of your phone. Sometimes it'll give you some capabilities that is not available in the interface through the Google Home or Amazon Echo. But if you want just the basic functionality, you can actually uninstall the manufacturer's app after it's set up. And you could get rid of that potential there.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. But point well taken, because most people probably wouldn't remove it. I know that I have some Wemo plugs, and I have the Wemo app on all my devices because it's a real easy way for me to set my schedules for my my smart plugs, and I've never removed them. So, yeah, point taken that I'm worried not only about Google Home vulnerability, but also Wemo vulnerabilities at that point. We have a comment from Bob H. The robotic vacuums send the layout of your entire home to China. I assume that, Bob, you're joking on that.
No,
you don't know for a fact?
No, he's not. So I read this. Well, I think I read the same article.
Okay.
That's no problem. You just move the coffee table and the burglar will trip over it.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we are past the 8:30, so we're just coming up on 8:34. Do we have any last-minute things that people want to bring up? And if not, we will cut things off. So
yeah, I just want to let Bob Harris know that I enjoy watching the inside of his home through his Wyze cameras.
Yeah, you have one in your bedroom there, Bob.
Okay, it sounds like it's time to wrap this thing up.
I think you're right. So, yeah, thanks all for showing up. We had a total of 32 people at our max there, so I think that's great. And I guess we'll turn it over to Alan for the last couple of slides.
Two things. The next thing is coming up on Monday. Chris had mentioned KeepAs, so I think that's what the keeping passwords safe session at the library is going to include. So that's on Monday, December.
Yeah, it'll be talking about that, and then also generically a bunch of issues around passwords and digital inheritance and some things like that. This also is going to be on the more basic side of using things at the, I believe, March meeting of the PC user group. I'm going to be giving a presentation that extends on that with some more advanced capabilities.
Okay, so if you want to know how to keep your password safe, that's Monday, December the 7th at 10 a.m. And remember, the library, you have to register because they will send out an email with the login credentials. So you need to register ahead of time. And next up, our December meeting is on December the 9th. And Lars is going to be talking about Wi-Fi with all kinds of tips, tricks, and traps, I guess. So that's our meeting on the 9th, Wednesday, which is next week. And next week is also going to be our next Q&A, and that will be after Lawrence's presentation, as usual. And so, again, if you have questions and you want to answer any of the questions that Chris puts on the announcement list, or things that you want to share, Android smart apps or PC programs, send everything along to suggestion box at opcug.ca. Thanks, everyone, for attending. Hope you found something of interest. I know I did. And we'll see you next week.
Bye, folks. See you next week.
Thank you, gentlemen.